If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to episode 218 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at the Turbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
We live in a world where almost everything, from groceries and streaming to banking, shopping, and even learning, can be done with just a few taps. Life has never been easier, at least on the surface. But each time we make something simpler, we also change the habits, relationships, and responsibilities that come with it. Convenience saves time, but it can also make us careless about the labor behind it, the environment that sustains it, and the patience it replaces. Rick, at what point do you think making life easier starts making us worse, meaning making us less patient, less responsible, and, well, perhaps even less human?
It happens at the point where we forget our dependencies on others, the extent to which we're dependent on other people for our well-being, dependent on the environment, on especially healthy environment, and dependent on institutions that serve us.
You know, one thing as I was looking into this, and there's been a lot written about this actually over the last few years, and there was an essay in what is probably my favorite named student newspaper I have come across. You know, we'll do a call out here. At your University of Viterbo, you have the
Lumen,
which
means light.
Light, that seems like fine. In Vanderbilt University, they have The Hustler, which I thought was amusing. But anyway, there is an essay in the Vanderbilt Hustler, and we'll link to this, says that hyper-individualism and convenience culture are eroding our sense of collective responsibility. The author goes on to say that we become accustomed to getting what we want instantly, and when that happens often enough, it starts to feel like a moral right instead of a privilege. And I guess it's probably not a surprise that so much of our economy and so much of our lives are just talking about efficiency, right? I mean, there's so many people whose like entire jobs are, how can I, you know, if you're a huge company and you can like save 1% of people's times, well, that's like hundreds and hundreds of hours a week, and you scale it over a year. So, I mean, efficiency has, and then maybe you're able to do that and you get a big raise because shareholders are happy. And this is all stuff that people think about a lot. Do we overvalue efficiency?
If you think of where we are sitting in terms of human history, and for pretty much all of human history, huge effort was exerted to creating just a few moments of leisure. I would say for the vast majority of that history, only the very wealthy had any leisure time at all, right? So when you talk about convenience, they had people that would serve them, that would bring them the food, so they aren't raising their own food. They're not doing manual labor, that sort of thing. But everybody else is working and sleeping, and you're raising kids, and you're, you know, like you're—
And big families.
All of a sudden, with industrialization, becomes this— For a majority of people, you get these, what we called for a while, modern conveniences, different kinds of household appliances and supermarkets. So you aren't shopping many different places. You're going to one place to get all of your groceries, and you don't have to have your own garden anymore. You can pick up fresh fruits and vegetables. All these things happen in relatively a recent, you know, span of time when we look at human history. And so we've never been at a place where we say, oh, do we have too much leisure? Do we have too much convenience? What is it doing to our society? And I think we're noticing now that the struggle for life also kind of reminds us of the ways in which we're interdependent, and it helps us to really create community bonds in ways that we've lost. We find like all kinds of different signs that community relationships are fraying or disappearing. And so for the first time, we're asking, do we have too much convenience? But this is such a new question in human history. It really hasn't been asked before.
Well, and it seems like, I mean, if you look back to the not so distant past, I mean, some of the first inventions that really sort of made people's lives easier, like I'm thinking like refrigeration, right? I mean, I can only imagine what it was like. And there were people who like lived this over a matter of a couple of decades where they went from literal ice boxes to like a Kenmore refrigerator plugged in their kitchen. And like, that's a big game changer. I don't think either of us want to go back to lives before refrigerators and freezers. We think of clothes washing machines or laundry facility. That again, I never scrubbed my laundry on a washboard, but I think having an electric washer is a pretty good thing. But you know, but it just seems so. You solve those problems, and you know, I'm sure the refrigerator. Oh, go ahead.
And it's changed our life so much that we no longer think of having a wash machine, an automatic wash machine, right? Even the words automatic, we don't use anymore.
Yeah, of course.
Right, there were manual washers. We don't think of that as a convenience anymore. It's a necessity. If your washing machine breaks, you're like,
yeah,
how long before?
If you're, you know, a low-income person, you may not have your own, but you can go to a laundromat and put some quarters in and it'll do the work for you.
So there's all kinds of things that we now think of as necessities that our grandparents thought of as luxuries.
And then also, though, you think of, you know, I don't know who the early makers of these appliances were. I said Kenmore, maybe that wasn't around back then. But if you were Sears, which was around back then, was making all this money on these like newfangled refrigerators and clothes washing machines. And so it's only natural to think, we'll make these a little better over time, but we sort of solved that problem. So what problem can we solve next? And, you know, maybe just off the top of my head, one that comes to mind are like dishwashers, right? I mean, I would think that almost everybody would say if you had to get rid of your dishwasher or your clothes washer, people are going to get rid of their dishwasher first. So it's like not as critical, but it's still pretty nice. And then so you solve that problem. And then you kind of work up this hierarchy of needs. And now we're like, well, which voice assistant is best to turn off my lights or turn on my lights when I give it an audio command? Or which smart home feature can I automate the best so my lights go on at just the right time? And, you know, there's different choices, but like maybe that problem is almost all solved now. So, I mean, it's just interesting that it seems like we can continue to solve problems, but the problems we're solving are not nearly as big as like a refrigerator was.
As we solve all those problems or things we considered problems, which were time-intensive, labor-intensive tasks that we had to do on a regular basis, we aren't thinking of all the relationship building that we did in the doing of those tasks very often. So I remember as a child, before any homes around within my extended family had dishwashers, that was something that you would always do when a meal was done. Somebody needed to wash the dishes, and somebody would be washing, and another person would be drying.
And be a two-person job.
And sometimes it would be a three-person job with another person putting things away after they were dried.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have all these conversations that would happen in the process of doing that. What we've done is we've lost all these opportunities for community building. A few years ago, I listened to a fascinating talk by a guy who worked for Engineers Without Borders. And he was talking about how they had done a project in several villages in rural Africa that where they had dug new wells because there had been a lot of disease. And it was very time intensive, especially for women and girls in the village to walk. I think it was a 3-mile trek to get clean water.
Get clean water.
And to bring it back to the village. And because of that, most girls couldn't go to school because they had to be carrying water. They had done these new wells in several villages. When they came back several months later to see like what were the effects, and they were expecting a lot of praise and a lot of thanks it turned out that most of the women in those villages were really angry with them because instead of freeing up their time to spend more time with community, because they were living in such a patriarchal society, which their time was kind of controlled by the husbands, they were spending most of their days isolated indoors. And when they were carrying water, they were with other people in the village, and they were talking to one another. And this is where they built their relationships and developed relationships. And so they were very upset about this new modern convenience of not having to carry water because it made them more isolated. And I love the story because it's a nice metaphor for the ways that we only think of the benefits of any new convenience. We don't think about what is it taking away. And oftentimes what any kind of convenience takes away is our dependency on one another.
And it's interesting, just to tease out that story a little more, I mean, I think it's almost certain that the people who put in this well close to the where folks were living were only thinking of the good this would be, right? And
yep.
But I also wonder, though, if when they were talking about this to the people and saying, here's this new thing, right, that my guess is that they even at that moment didn't realize what they were soon about to lose, right? They were like, well, geez, I mean, walking 3 miles to get fresh water every day may not seem like a fun time, and I can just walk 50 yards to get water. Well, that seems like a pretty good bargain. I would wonder, and my guess is they probably even when first told about this, were not thinking of the consequences. And certainly these engineers never thought about those consequences.
Yeah. And I think that's what we all face when we are presented with something that's a convenience for us, that frees up our time. We aren't thinking like, how is it going to change our life? How is it going to change our daily interactions? We're really focused on what did we dislike doing that we can now avoid and free up our time. But then we have to ask, like, free up our time for what? Like, what are we going to do with this increased time? And often we don't have a good answer for that.
I think it can sometimes go that way. The other thing, and I remember hearing about this, and I forget in what context, but I'm pretty sure it was accurate, is that as New York City, and I'm sure probably other cities around the world too, was really starting to become a denser, more populated place and more commerce was being done there. And this would have been around the turn of the 19th to 20th century. The only way wealthy and non-wealthy people really got around other than walking were horses, right? And horses, you know, think of all the horses that were being used for transportation back then. But in New York City, at least, and probably other places, there was a ridiculously serious concern about the feces that horses left behind. And there were cities that were like, I don't know what we're going to do because we think our population is going to continue to grow. People want to get around and we don't have any like way to deal with this. Well, in a matter of years, this became not a problem at all because cars showed up. Now, you can extrapolate this decades down the road and cars have their own sort of byproduct issues that we all know about. But at the time, cars seemed like the answer to their prayers because you didn't have these piles of on the corner everywhere that were terribly unhealthy or unsafe, and you know, and for all the reasons we understand. So, like, I guess I just bring that up because there are times where sort of these things come along at just the right time that do seem to like that. I guess not every piece of progress is bad,
but every piece of progress changes. It doesn't change just what we do individually. It changes how we interact with one another.
And I'm sure, setting aside the horse excrement issue, the cars certainly changed how people got around and interacted with each other when horses mostly went away.
Yeah, yeah. And that change of interaction isn't bad. I think where it can be bad. It could be good. It could be bad. And it's usually some combination of the two. I think where it becomes really detrimental, though, is where the changes happen so quickly that we're not able to adjust new forms of social life to keep up with the constant disruption. And I think that's where we're at this kind of critical point right now. And I think that's why we're talking about not just individualism, but hyper-individualism, right? Where we have convenience after convenience changing our daily patterns of interaction so rapidly, we haven't had time as a society to adjust or develop new forms of social interaction that keep us connected to one another. And so we're finding is the increase in polarization and rude behavior and like kind of a general meanness that has crept into society that a lot of people are noticing and asking, like, where did this come from? Right.
And you and I weren't around when horses stopped becoming the popular form of transportation and cars came on the scene. But we have been both around when social media has sort of gone from nothing to an idea Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room to all the social media platforms today. You could argue whether in totality it's been a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it is hard to say anything, but it is not what we thought it would be. I mean, I remember, well, not too long ago, I don't have the exact time in front of me, but remember the Arab Spring, and we thought that this like connection, in this case, Twitter was sort of the prominent actor, would be like a democratizing force in the Middle East, and that people could communicate peer to peer and not be controlled by their governments as much, and that it was just going to bring democracy and freedom to a part of the world that had seen it in a very long time, if ever. Well, that hasn't happened, and there's just a lot of things out there where you create these tools, whether they're washing machines, clean wells in villages, or large social media companies, where you just don't know where this is going to go. And of course, although the social media arc is, you know, many ways we're well into, we're just in the beginning right now, of course, of this AI transformation. And there are a lot of people understandably skeptical about this. But I think one thing it's probably going to do, and in some cases maybe has done, is done what you talked about at the very beginning of the show, giving people more free time. And I don't know, I'm sure there's been surveys done on this, but it just seems like people always say things like, oh, I wish I had more time for myself. I wish I had more time to do the things I want to do. But it just seems like when we're given those times, and certainly over the past 100 years as a society, we have much more time to do things we want to do. We just don't seem to use that time well.
No. And like when AI puts a whole bunch of us out of work, we're going to have a lot more free time.
Yeah.
You're like, and I don't think that's the kind of free time most people want. But I loved your example of Arab Spring, because this was really the first time we noticed like so how easy it made social media made for people to join protests, to join a cause together, to organize large groups of people around a cause. And at that same time, we start seeing the rise of this term social justice as a thing. And it's primarily spread by social media and makes it easier for people to sign on to different causes and organize kind of events. But here's the strange thing. At the same time, we see a real rise in what we'd say people signing on to social justice causes. We have a real decline in personal responsibility. There's also an increase in anonymity online, of people saying really rude things to one another, kind of piling on, like the cancel culture develops, where like we don't have the patience to listen to people that we disagree with, so we want to exclude them from our spaces. It's a rise in like contradictory like attitudes. Like you would think if you have a real commitment to social justice, that would mean a real commitment to connect with other people and to be responsible for one another's welfare. But when the technology allows us to be much more independent, it means even our commitment to causes can be kind of abstract and be a matter of convenience. Well, I can quickly make a post. I can register my disapproval of something, but I don't have to actually show up or learn more about it or actually talk through my disagreement with somebody.
This next section I'm going to call Scott's First World Problems. So I want to just talk to you about something that's going on in my life, like right now. And this, again, I don't want to overstate this. This is not like some terrible calamity, but I think fits into our discussion today. This past weekend, I decided, and I've been thinking about this for a while, that I needed a new desk chair for my home office. Just the one I had was not especially sturdy. I got it when I started working at home. It's done fine, but I decided it was time to go out and buy a new office chair for my home office. So I go out to the one sort of widely known office superstore chain that we have across our country, and they had probably 30 chairs, we'll say, on display. And you know, some of them you kind of look at and like, well, that's like, you know, $60. It's not going to be any good. And so I kind of tried a bunch of them out, and then I'm like sort of settled on one that I'm like, oh, this one I really kind of like, and the price seems fine and whatever. And it wasn't on sale, and I didn't need this right away. So I just, they actually had a little tear-off strip at the store, so you could take it and go home, and you could order it on this particular store's website and all that stuff. So I took that off. And so I go home later that day, and lo and behold, this is not I thought this was maybe a brand that just this store carried, but no, it's carried widely by various people. And there is a well-known e-commerce platform that I'm not sure you've heard of called Amazon. Mm-hmm. That I found this same chair on that was $100 less. So I'm like, well, that's like real money. And this, and I'm not like, it's not between this and some small independent retailer. This other place was a large retailer as well. So I'm like, fine, I'm going to purchase this through Amazon and save $100 and have it delivered to my home. So I put the order in. And for reasons I don't quite understand all the intricacies of Amazon, many times you can order something and it'll be at your doorstep within a day or two. This one, it said it was going to be a little while longer, like another week or so. Well, whatever. I mean, I don't need a chair tomorrow. So that did not bother me in the least. Then I realized that the delivery window was Thursday or Friday of this week. Okay, that's fine. Except Friday morning, we're leaving to go out of town for a long weekend. And we have very nice neighbors, and I'm sure if it was delivered after we left Friday morning, they would be more than happy. We've done this for them. But when I've done it for them, it's been like something that's like the size of, you know, something very easy to carry around. This has a little more. So I'm like, oh, I wish there were a way to go on to the Amazon site, either delay the shipment or maybe expedite the shipment or somehow maybe deliver it inside my garage, which they offer. So I went on there, and no, there's no choice. I mean, and this, again, there's various different delivery schemes, and this was one where, nope, it's going to come Thursday or Friday. It's just the way it goes. However, if there was a choice on, if I could have clicked a box and said guaranteed Thursday delivery for an extra $10, I would have clicked that box and been happy that I knew it was going to arrive before we left. So this is a long wind up to say that that box didn't exist. But had it existed, I would have paid the $10. I never would have considered, though, that does this mean that my delivery driver has to work a longer day? Or does this mean that somehow the shipment is not being handled in a way that's reducing the environmental impact? Maybe they're running a special truck out or something. I don't know. I mean, there's all sorts of variables and costs that, you know, they're charging me $10 for a reason probably. And maybe that covers it. Maybe it doesn't. But like, there's so much of our lives where we just can click a box and say, oh, we'll pay a little more because it's more convenient for us. And we just don't think of all those other many possibilities in this case, a supply chain from a warehouse to my doorstep, we just don't think about. Is that something we should think about more?
We certainly should, because we should think about all of our actions and what are the effects of taking those actions. And like what, and the primary effect is, what is the effect on other people? And yet we live in an economy right now where it is really hard. We do so many actions that have effects on people that we don't encounter, like the delivery driver.
Yeah, probably we'll never see him or her.
But also the people that are working in the shipping
in the warehouse
business, in the warehouse, the people that are producing the products. And if you think about, like, for all of your consumer choices, like all the people that contribute to that, like, it would be a full-time job to just try to figure out, like, where does this all come from, and how does my decision to buy one thing versus another, like, how does that affect everybody?
Would it have been better, I used air quotes, which you shouldn't use on a podcast, by the way, but would it be better to have just say, to heck with the $100, I'm just going, this chair was in stock at a local store, give them money that day, put it in the back of my car and bring it home. I mean, that would have maybe been less of an environmental footprint. Should that have something I should have considered?
Yes, but then you don't really know the business practices of that store mm-hmm. versus the other store or where they got the supply. You know, like what does that extra $100 go to fund?
Mm-hmm.
Like
some guy's job or some employee or directly to the employees or yeah.
So one of the exercises I would have students do in ethics classes quite often is I would ask them to look at the clothes that they were wearing, do some research on the brands, find out where they are being made, what materials are being made, what is the environmental footprint of the company, what are the labor practices of the producers and the sellers, and some of the information they'd be able to find, some they couldn't. But if you think of what you're wearing quite a few different clothes, and so that's looking up several companies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then think of, like, of all the clothes that you possess, think about doing that kind of exercise for all of them. That's a lot of work.
And, like, think of grocery stores purchases.
Exactly. Now, I think we should pay attention to when there's obviously really bad products, very bad practices by certain corporations, and there will occasionally be boycotts, mm-hmm. right, of companies where it comes to attention that there's really bad labor practices, for example, or bad environmental practices. But it's nearly impossible, really, to know what goes into all of the choices that we make. And I think we end up making a lot of choices out of convenience simply because we're very busy. Most of us are in a very fast-paced moving world where, like, we have to make choices based on convenience, because it's not that all of these new conveniences have given us a whole bunch of extra discretionary time. It's that we have more time to do more things. And so we filled up all that time with all kinds of more tasks. And like for most people that are working right now, the productivity of each person in this modern economy is much greater than it was 20 years ago or 50 or certainly 100 years ago.
And it's much more measured too.
It's much more measured. Yeah. So it's not like what we were promised, we're going to keep having these modern conveniences to free up time and give us more leisure. It's only freed us up to do a lot more work. It's given us a little bit more leisure, but it's freed us up to be more productive. That's why I'm also skeptical of what will happen with AI. I don't think AI is going to give us more leisure time. I think it's going to increase productivity. Whether that will improve our lives or not, that remains to be seen. I'm skeptical that it will.
I don't get to say this very often, so I'll say it again. To go back to the Vanderbilt Hustler article, but we touched on this briefly, but I wanted to kind of close on this. It talks about a larger cultural trend called hyper-individualism, and it suggests that the more effortless life becomes, the more we imagine ourselves as independent actors and not part of some larger system. I haven't talked to you about this, but I'm guessing you think that's bad.
Yeah.
Why?
Because we are part of a larger system. We are not independent actors. And so what it's doing is it's creating the illusion of being independent actors. And I think we should have lives that are grounded in reality. And we are more and more living in kind of an illusory world. And I think there, in on some levels, there's a real awareness of that. There's a real, this is what contributes to a lot of conspiracy thinking. Somebody else is pulling the levers. Mm-hmm. There's things going on behind the scene. There's somebody else really in charge. I think a lot of the conspiracy theories are just wrong. But the idea that there's somebody behind the scene pulling the levers, that's actually true. We are operating more in a world where we're interacting with the appearances, and there's something else that's controlling those appearances that we don't have access to, and we never see, and we cannot change, we cannot interact with or change or have any effect on.
And sort of the last point I wanted to bring up around this is we certainly know that our culture in many ways has become more disposable. We talked at the beginning about large kitchen appliances and things like washing machines. And it's not just my opinion. It's a fact that if you bought a washing machine in 1975, it could last you 25 years. And if you buy a washing machine today, due to the nature of the machines, and there's all sorts of, you know, reasons, they might last 5 or 10 years, right? And I think that, among many other things, leads us to a society where, and because we're so used to this frictionless experience that when something stops working, when something breaks, when we can't figure out how to fix something easily, we are just way too happy to say, well, done with that one, time for a new one. And I just think that there are times where, you know, adding some friction there and saying, hey, how can I fix this? And I think, I guess, you know, certainly one of the best things that's come out of the internet is that if you have a 1993 Whirlpool clothes washer that's making a sound, you can probably go on YouTube and find some handy person pulling it apart and showing you how to fix it, right? So, like, there's lots of that out there. But I just think, in general, we have become too easy to say, well, that seems like work, and I can just push a button, in effect, and get a new, brand new one with maybe an extra feature or two I didn't have before delivered to my door. And I don't really have to worry myself about, like, how things work. And that's probably not good.
Yeah. So mechanically, things have become much more complex.
Yeah. Right. Circuits and.
Yeah. And also, labor costs are so great that having something repaired is often either as expensive or more expensive than replacing the product, or, like, it's not really worth, like, if you have a product that's, say, 10 years old and you're looking at the labor costs and you're thinking, okay, I can get this problem fixed, but another problem is going to happen in 2 years. Is it worth that cost?
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't even think there's a TV repair shop in our city, for example. Like, you know, because nobody repairs TVs anymore.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking about things that maybe you spend 20 minutes on and can fix yourself.
So I just fixed my washing machine recently.
Oh.
And it's about, I don't know, about 8 years old. And it turned out it needed a fairly minor part. It needed some washers. It was really banging. And so it would start banging and the spin cycle would stop. And it needed some more washers that kind of balance the tub, you know, when it's spinning. It was maybe a 20-minute repair. But it took me much longer than that to find out what the problem was and like, where to get the parts.
And I'm sure the parts were inexpensive.
Yeah, they were, you know, like, they were $15
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
And so yeah.
That was friction, right? There was friction, like, to diagnose this, to find the parts, to take the back off the machine. I mean, that was not your easy. The easiest thing would have been, to heck with it, I'll just buy a new one.
Yeah. And I imagine that not everybody could do it.
Mm-hmm.
like just navigating the like, determining the cause and figuring out what the solution would be was harder than actually doing the physical repair. But then the physical repair was a little bit challenging and didn't take a long time, but I could find a YouTube video of somebody showing how to do it. But there are other things that break down which would probably take about the same amount of work, but I wouldn't be able to figure out what the solution is. And so in that case, I'm probably not going to look for somebody to come and fix it. I'm mm-hmm. just going to get rid of
replace it.
And that's become much more common. I can't remember what the point of this discussion was.
The point I was trying to make, I think, though, is that as things become less, there's less friction built into things, that we're so used to the convenience of things that I think part of that process is we don't want to figure out how things work, that we're just so used to buying something and it works until it doesn't, and then we buy something again.
Yeah, it's partly that really advanced kinds of equipment have become so affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some things that aren't, but for the most part, like for what you get right now compared to other times in history, like washing machines are expensive, but they cost less than what they cost my parents for buying a brand new washing machine, like in $1970, for example.
Yeah.
We've developed a throwaway disposable economy for the sake of convenience. That means we're filling up landfills, which is not a good thing. We're not repairing things as much. But I think the worst thing about it is that we don't have people doing the repair. Like it used to be, you'd regularly have people coming into your home to do different things. My dad was a house painter. He knew everybody in our community because everybody needed things done in their homes because he also had a paint store. So people were coming in to buy paint, but they were also like hiring him to do their work. And I lived in an area where there was a lot of cottages around lakes. I remember drive down some of these roads and he would say, like, I painted this one and this one and this one. Like there would be, you know, we'd drive past 20 homes and he would have painted 10 of them. There's that kind of social interaction that comes when we are always like doing this work for one another. I was maybe like 14 or 15. He had a headlight go out on the car and he asked me to take it down to the service station, which was only a few blocks away. And I said, I think I could replace that. And he said, no, we'll have the service station do that. I paint their house. Mm. They repair my car. And this was the way in which, you know, many communities operated. You were interacting with people all the time to do things for you, and you would do things for them. And all of that was a building relationships and building strength in communities. And I think it's one of the reasons why we are so much more polarized today is that we don't interact on a daily basis with people from different kind of economic, social backgrounds and with different ideas about politics or what they think would be good for our communities or society. We don't have these daily interactions to the extent that people used to. And I think we have less patience and understanding because we have less friction. Like every one of those interactions causes friction in today's term, but that's good for us.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com. AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, I hear you have one for me.
Yes. So, Scott, let's say that you own a small tourist business and you have a few employees, not a lot, just like 4 or 5 employees, but you're having troubles with one of them. And this, like, we'll call him Eric. And Eric has been with you since you started the business about 10 years ago. Very loyal person. You really like him. he's challenged when it comes to interacting with customers, and especially when he has too many tasks or too many demands at once. Sometimes he will lose his patience and he will just blow up at somebody. Because of that, you've been receiving some very negative reviews on Google and other online places talking about the terrible customer service. And you know it's all because they were there at one of these times when Eric just kind of blew up at somebody. You've talked to him about this a number of times, but it's not really something he can control. He's not the kind of person that handles that very well. There's also no other job for him. You only have a few employees and they all have to interact with customers. What do you do in a case like this? Because you know that if you fire Eric, he may not be able to get another job. Do you have a responsibility to keep him on because he's been a loyal employee, even though it's causing you some lost business?
Question. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being nearly failed and 10 being ridiculously successful, how successful is this business?
I would say you're just making it.
3 or 4?
3 or 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because if it were 10, that would be different maybe, that like you can ignore a few bad reviews, but that doesn't seem to be the case. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. Oddly for someone my age, I've had very few jobs. I should say more specifically, I've worked for very few companies. And I've only worked for large companies. The difference is, like, I've never worked for a place like you described that has, you know, an owner slash boss and then like 4 people working under him. And that's got to be a much different experience than any I've been in. But at the same time, I would imagine that those relationships you have between your boss, between the few colleagues there, are even more critical, right? Because like you said, you can't say, oh, this person just does this and this person just does that. There's no way in a company or an organization of that size. So I think that your job as the owner and person in charge is to continually, you know, hopefully that, you know, Eric's been aware of these issues. I mean, he doesn't sound like he's an idiot. He probably is aware that he acts this way sometimes, must be aware that there has been some negative feedback. I'm assuming as, you know, the owner, you've shared that with him. And because this is not a business that is just coasting along and rolling in cash, that, and again, I have never worked in a small business, but I would think that, you know, hopefully your employees don't think you're running the most successful business in America when you're just getting by. I mean, you hope there's some realization of that. I mean, so that all said, I think when you work, there's a lot of benefits probably to work for a small organization like that. But I think there is also some drawbacks. And part of it is that you have to, that everybody has to be pulling his or her own weight. It doesn't sound like this person is in a particular but important role. And if this is something you've talked about time and a time again, and clearly if it's a small organization, everybody else there knows what's going on. I mean, they have to like witness this and they'll be like, my gosh, why I wish that customer was dealing with Eric. I would have handled this, you know, so much better. That, yeah, I think at some point to benefit the other small number of people who work for you, and the bottom line of your company, that there, I think at some point you have to give Eric an ultimatum and say, you know, if this happens again, it's only going to happen one more time. And you sort of set this up as this is beyond his control. I mean, is it though? I mean, I think we all have some agency over how we behave and how we interact. I don't quite buy that. So I think I would have a serious discussion with him and be sort of transparent and saying, hey, things around here aren't going great. And we really depend on this type of business, depends on positive word of mouth and positive online reviews. You're doing nothing to help that. We need to stop this right now. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I haven't described it in a way that presents Eric as having disabilities for which you're responsible for making certain accommodations. I don't know if that's what's going on in the case I'm imagining, mm-hmm. I don't know if that would be the case. But what happens is Eric doesn't handle stress very well.
Yeah.
And so then is really sorry when he blows up and explodes at somebody. Whether that's under his control or not, I'm not so sure. But I think what you're saying is probably two things that you could do, like put some conditions, say, like, the behavior cannot happen again.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, maybe, like, I don't know if there'd be any way of working with the other employees to kind of head off the moments at which there might be, like, some really stressful escalations happening where they could head it off. I don't know if that's the case or not.
But, I mean, you just can't help but think that, I mean, if you got rid of Eric, that you're in a position, we'll presume, that you'll be able to hire someone else to replace Eric. That if this person is as good as your other two or three or four employees, how much better things would be? I mean, it'd be hard not to look at it that way.
And it would be better for the other employees.
Oh,
that's right. It wouldn't just be better for your business.
And that's why I hate to, like, say, well, gang, we know Eric's a trouble here, but, you know, Susie, Bobby, and Ted, next time we see something happen and it's your job to step in and sort of, you're probably not paying them well enough to take on that extra responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're discussing this dilemma at the tail end of a discussion about hyper-individualism and the, you know, the lack of friction. And, I mean, this is, I think one of the things that happens in much larger companies is it becomes easier to terminate somebody like this, maybe because, well, you could maybe move him into
a position. If there's a position,
a
that's a better position,
fit. Yeah. Where they wouldn't have the stress. But I think you might also, like, as the owner or as a decision maker in a larger organization, not feel the extent of personal responsibility for Eric's livelihood that you would in a very small company.
Because you probably know Eric better.
Yeah.
But then the last question, and you know, this is maybe hard to say, but if you're seeing this behavior, let's say you've seen, we'll just say Eric's worked for this company for 2 years, and this behavior has been apparent for most of those 2 years, right? At some point, as the boss, and presumably the person who hired this guy, do you hold any responsibility for, like, making a bad hire? I mean, it's maybe tough to know how someone's going to react in that situation. It's not like you hired somebody to spend his entire day working on spreadsheets and they've never once opened Excel. Well, you probably should have caught that earlier. This is something that's a little bit different than that. But it does seem like there's sort of some responsibility on the hiring person that, hey, I made the wrong call here.
That could be. It could be that, like, Eric's behavior has gradually gotten worse. It could be that as the business has grown slightly, these stressful situations arise more frequently than they did.
Or maybe the opposite. Maybe as the, you know, using my 1 to 10 scale, maybe that when he started, the business was a 7 or 8, and you had to shed a few people or have been able to replace positions, and things are getting a little tighter. That could also lead to this.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of different factors that could go into, because we're talking about a hypothetical here, but this is one of those gray areas where I think there's a lot of gray room for good judgment to be exercised. But I think the main consideration is what you pointed out, is what are the effects on the other employees? You've only got a few other employees, and does this burden them too much?
And the last thing you want
to make it hard for them,
you know, Susie, who does a great job, all of a sudden, as you're kind of hemming and hawing about what to do about Eric, she's like, hey, I got a job and it, like, the pay's about the same and it's like similar work, but I don't have to deal with, I mean, she doesn't quite come out and say, but, like, I don't have to deal with Eric. Well, if you lose Susie and you have to replace her, and then maybe you're going to replace the next person, and that's, you know, takes your already struggling business and making things worse.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the worst things you can do in any kind of business is keep a bad actor too long, because they can really destroy your workplace culture very quickly.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.